This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, the CIAA tournament comes to town in spite of HB2, and there is movement on that front in North Carolina and nationally. Governor Roy Cooper proposes a teacher pay raise over the next 2 years, new numbers on the population of charter schools, and an update on student assignment. And this just in, and it may come as a surprise to you, Charlotte traffic is deemed not that bad. Our roundtable of reporters is set to talk about those stories and more, and we're joined by Tom Bullock from WFAE News. Good morning.
Good morning.
Glenn Birkins, editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com, has returned in spite of his better judgment. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Eric Spanberg is here from the Charlotte Business Journal, where he is senior staff writer. How you doing?
Good morning.
And Ann Doss Helms, education reporter for the Charlotte Observer, rounds out the panel. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
And you can join us. Reach us through email at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook, get us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks, and use the hashtag WFAE Roundup. The CIAA tournament tipped off this week. It's the last tournament standing in the wake of HB2, and the week after the NBA All-Star game was played, not here, but in New Orleans. So, Eric, as other events, particularly sporting events, have pulled out of Charlotte and North Carolina, did most people think that we would lose the CIAA this time around?
Well, I think there was certainly some concern last fall when the announcements were made by the ACC about the football championship and the NCAA, which started it by saying it would not have any neutral site events in North Carolina. But the CIAA moved 8 of its 10 neutral site events out of North Carolina. The two that stayed here, obviously, were the men's and women's basketball tournaments, which are played here this week. And ever since then, the CIAA commissioner has been fairly positive on staying in Charlotte, I think because the tournament has done so well here. The alums like visiting here, and they're very reluctant to move it. At the same time, the CIAA says they are very much against HB2, so it's a bit of a mixed message there.
And earlier this week, in an interview with WFAE's Morning Edition host Marshall Terry, CIAA Commissioner Jackie McWilliams said that keeping the tournament here in Charlotte was the right thing to do.
The thought of moving the tournament out that quickly, I think, brings a little bit of anxiety about how that is for us to have to move something this big in the magnitude. But at the end of the day, we have a commitment here to 2020. We have contracts and obligations that we need to meet. And I think the board's decision to stay to meet those obligations was a great decision.
Now, other leagues and conferences and teams and et cetera ignored their contracts and commitments. Why is it?
Well, and the CIAA did, too, on 8 of its events.
So is this a good thing that they actually honored the contract?
Well, I'm not going to say it's a good thing or a bad thing. I think what you have to realize with the CIAA is that as an athletic conference, it's basically a North Carolina thing.
Ah.
There are 11 CIAA schools. 8 of them are in North Carolina. So if you take the CIAA out of North Carolina, you're really moving it away from its fan base. You're moving away from from its institutional footprint. It would have been a very tough thing for them to do to actually move the CIAA out of North Carolina.
And Glenn, you have said that it's the fan base is waning for the CIAA.
Locally, I am hearing that. I'm hearing that across the board. In fact, I was talking with someone just this morning on my way in, and she was saying Friday was typically her day that she would go to hang out and catch CIAA events. She's not doing that this year. On social media, on conversations I'm having, I call it tournament fatigue. This is the 12th year the tournament has been in Charlotte. And I think where there was a lot of excitement initially, locals at least, are kind of getting used to it. I talked to Commissioner McWilliams earlier this week, and she said something that frankly surprised me. Starting next year, I think they recognize that the local fan base may be getting a little fatigued. They're going to try to reach out to a broader audience. And what that means is they're going to try to reach out to more whites, Latinos, try to increase that fan base beyond its African-American roots.
Just coming downtown today and yesterday, last year I recall the traffic being intense on Thursday and Friday morning, and it wasn't that bad.
Thursday is typically the day that people start coming in. Yeah. They did start yesterday, but I think you're absolutely right. So far, I've not seen the crowds that I would typically see on a Thursday, but maybe they're waiting to come in today.
Well, and the other thing is, Mike, you know, they moved from having the tournament the whole week at the big arena to 2 days at Bojangles.
Yeah. Last year, the event generated $57.4 million for the city of Charlotte. How much more important is that money now, considering all that we have lost, Eric?
Oh, I mean, it's absolutely essential. Look, even with before any of these defections, the CIAA is the single most important tourism event in the city each year. It's the largest. It's the most successful. And I think a lot of people have somehow missed that or been unaware of that. And then when you add in the fact that it occurs in late February, look, people are not clamoring to come to Charlotte in late February, some might argue ever.
It's
but certainly
like June.
Not late February.
It's like June.
Yeah.
The trees are blooming.
Usually it's rainy and cold right now, and the CIAA gives the hotels and the restaurants a really big boost. So, it's very important. I think what Glenn is saying is exactly right, though. Take out HB2 and the other factors. When you have any event somewhere for 12 consecutive years, it's hard to keep the enthusiasm
and
going.
And Katie Peralta had a good article in The Observer talking about how the CIAA is not just a group that pops in and out, how enmeshed they are in Charlotte's civic life, Chamber of Commerce, what have you, on an ongoing basis. And kind of relevant to this HB2 dispute, that there are going to be TED-style talks today in which people, in conjunction with the CIAA, will talk about how black issues and civil rights intersect with LGBTQ issues and things like that. So it's really a part of the fabric here.
Yes.
Well, I mentioned a second ago that it's like summer in Charlotte. The trees are in bloom a little early this year. Everybody has spring fever, including the people in Congress in Washington. They all took spring break. The trouble is their constituents have an even higher temperature of spring fever. And Robert Pittenger had a town hall meeting last night, but he did it, Tom Bullock, on the phone.
Yep, he did.
867-5309?
Exactly. It
was be a good song. 867-5309.
I'm not even sure how to respond to that.
Go ahead.
So Congressman Robert Pittenger, who's a Republican who represents North Carolina's 9th Congressional District, held this conference call basically with constituents. It is different. And officially, the reason that they gave for this teleconference town hall was that it was more convenient for constituents. Since the 9th stretches from South Charlotte to just outside of Fayetteville, you know, constituents wouldn't have to hop in the car and go for some, you know, a long drive in order to attend this town hall. And Pittenger's office says about 6,000 people took part in this conference call. But what you found out just from the first question was people wanted to know why it was not in person. And the first question was asked by a man named Mark. And here's what Congressman Pittenger, here's a telling answer that he gave Mark to the question, why is this not in person?
We have a broad district we want to reach out. But also, frankly, as you've watched the media, Mark, there are groups out there who seek to stage these protests and interfere with a civil discussion.
And Republicans have said the protests at other town halls around the country have been organized by the left and carried out by paid protesters. That is something that the callers on this conference call really wanted to make sure that Pittenger knew was not the case with them. One caller named Greg challenged the notion directly.
The anger and frustration that you're seeing on the TV is very real. There are a lot of Americans, good Americans, not protesters or agitators. They're good Americans who are deeply disturbed, embarrassed and frightened by President Trump's conduct and his willingness to undermine the judiciary, our voting process, press, all for personal and political gain.
Now, most of the questions, there was actually only 9 questions that were asked and answered in this hour-long tele-town hall. And most of them actually dealt with Trump, big questions about Trump. Mm-hmm. One caller wanted to know if Robert Pittenger would push him to release his tax returns. No was the answer that caller received because it's not against the law.
Yeah,
exactly. And then others wanted to know about the Russia investigation and ties.
Wouldn't releasing the tax returns be part of that investigation?
It's possible. We don't know yet because we don't know exactly it. Remember, it's not Donald Trump himself who is being investigated by the two intelligence subcommittees in Congress. It's contacts between his campaign staffers or alleged contacts between his campaign staffers and Russians.
They're going to talk more about these town hall meetings around the country where citizens have been very angry and very loud and very insistent that their questions get answered on point coming up in the next hour. But I listened to a podcast last week called Pod Save America.
It's number one.
Is it?
And yeah, it's been done, number one for about a month.
Mm-hmm. And it's done by the former speechwriters in the Obama administration, and they had a guest on the podcast who was, I've forgotten what organization he's from, but these protesters are not being paid, mm-hmm. but they are being advised on how to conduct themselves, how to spread out through the crowd, how to insist that sure. their questions
are being
answered.
MoveOn.org and other groups.
And it's patterned on the Tea Party.
That's exactly yeah. right. And it's actually something that Anna and I were talking about before the show. What's interesting here, and you see this hypocrisy in both parties. Before you had Democrats complaining about disruption and protesters that were the Tea Party members that you're mentioning.
Right.
When they held town halls back when the Tea Party movement was, you know, just coming into its own, now you have Republicans who are complaining about the Democrats using the exact same techniques.
Yeah, and you remember the Democrats blamed the Koch brothers for all of the protests. And in similar fashion, now Republicans are saying it's MoveOn.org. So,
well,
yes,
they're not,
you're right.
That's right. They're not being paid, but George Soros is standing right, outside right, the door of each
right.
of these locations.
Sure, I mean, but it is really eerie and, you know, sad that both parties are so hypocritical about this.
Yeah, but the key thing here is, guess what? That's democracy.
Yes.
People get the chance to protest. People get the chance to ask questions. And that, I honestly believe, and this is just my personal opinion, that is part of choosing to run and serve in public office.
Well, not only that, Tom. I mean, if we're – let's just say it is a big cabal hatched first by the Koch brothers and then by MoveOn and George Soros or whoever you want to pick. In the America of Citizens United, that would be perfectly okay as well.
Yeah. And the one thing I do want to mention is – there's kind of a narrative out there that these town halls are not being held. There's no guarantee that any congressperson has to hold a town hall. Mm-hmm. There will only be two town halls in North Carolina over this recess, one by a Democrat, which is G.K. Butterfield, and Robert Pittenger's, which was held last night. So it is interesting. There is a movement going on here. You are seeing these things happening at town halls across the country. But it's also worth noting that, you know, for there's been a lot of calls for people that, like, you know, so-and-so is not holding a town hall. It's not mandated. It's a choice thing.
It's not mandated, but I think what you said earlier, Tom, is the point, which is when you're in office, when you run for office, it is, to a lot of people, an expected part of the ceremony. And I think that politicians on either side who take the heat, so to speak, who hang in there and listen to these complaints – typically benefit.
They win.
And
yeah.
in some of those districts where they're not holding those town hall meetings, they're taking a beating as well. Mm-hmm. I've seen some of the elected officials' faces on milk cartons. I've seen have you seen this man on
we had the
utility.
Empty chair for Tillis, right?
Tom Tillis.
Yep.
Empty
chair.
Suits. In one city, in one district, they just put an empty suit in front of the audience. And
that's one of the things they're being advised by this group helping to make this these effective protests, to put a Xerox a picture of your congressperson, stick a suit under it, and put it on an empty chair.
And one of the ironies of this is that they have done town halls during regular times, and usually it's the representatives who are begging for coverage. You know, I'm coming to town, I'm talking to my constituents, and the rest of us are saying that's a snooze because they're going to talk about constituent issues. So now we've got an interest in it.
And, yes, we
and
do.
And they've lost their interest.
What we don't know yet is how deep this is. Mm-hmm. Is this something that is very surface and will mean nothing in, 2018, or right. if it's really something?
That's exactly
that's
right.
How long they
resonate.
Can sustain?
Will
this
the fever break, if we may continue Mike's analogy?
Yes, we have to take a break. Speaking of breaks, and we'll come back with more. And I think the winner this time is going to be Tom Bullock.
I win.
You win because he gets to talk about HB2.
Caller 7.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAU. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Corkscrew Wine Shop and Bar, located at Burkdale Village in Lake Norman, offering wines from around the world, live local music, and craft beer on tap. Relax, uncork, unwind. The Corkscrew, details at thescrewcrew.com. Well, although Dwayne Bett's life has been unique, he doesn't think of himself that way. He was a high school honor roll student who committed a crime that landed him in adult prison at the age of 16 for 8 years. A year and a half of that time was spent in solitary confinement. Today, he's out of prison. He's a college graduate with a law degree from Yale. He's written two books, and he's dedicated himself to shedding light on what he refers to as our mistaken opinions of the juvenile justice system. And he will share those thoughts with us on this program Monday at 9.
I'm Ray Suarez. Coming up on the next On Point, new deportation guidelines, fiery town hall meetings, the rollback of transgender policies, testing U.S.-Mexico ties. Our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
The news roundup continues with On Point from 10 to noon following Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's the weekly news roundup on Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins on WFAE and WFHE with Tom Bullock, reporter for WFAE News, Glenn Birkins, editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com, Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer for the Charlotte Business Journal, and Ann Dawes Helms, education reporter for the Charlotte Observer. In the legislature, there are some, because they listen to the show every week, there are some hoping that House Bill 2, HB 2, will be replaced. They don't want to hear us talk about it anymore. Replaced by House Bill 186. Tom Bullock, what is that?
House Bill 186, Mike, is the fifth bill introduced this legislative session, which again just started in January, to repeal HB 2. And this, it can be argued, is the closest thing we've seen to bipartisan compromise. And I'm doing air quotes here because I think both sides find issues with it. It does a couple of things, but let me start with why this one is different significantly, and that's because it has four primary sponsors, two Democrats and two Republicans, and they apparently sat down and have been hashing this out for quite a while. So it does, in the very beginning, say a full repeal of House Bill 2, but it then adds on some different things. First, it expands the state's current non-discrimination ordinance, which was created by House Bill 2, to include things like protected classes for pregnancy, familial status, genetic information, but it excludes LGBT protection. So,
yeah, the exact writing is race, sex, national origin, citizenship, religion, age, veteran status, genetic information, pregnancy, handicap, or disability.
Which falls in line with federal standards.
Okay.
But again, missing from there, gender identity, gender expression, sexual orientation. Those are big. For the LGBT community.
Particularly when we're talking about HB2.
Absolutely.
Right.
That's deliberate, obviously.
Yes. It is, absolutely. I don't think there's a thing in this bill that is not very deliberate. The second thing this does is it would allow municipalities, be them cities, counties, towns, whatever, to pass expanded non-discrimination protections, but with major, major caveats. First of all, they have to give notice that they're going to do this for 30 days before a vote. Second, if they pass an ordinance, there is a 90-day period where they have to wait before it is implemented. During that time, citizens can file a petition against the ordinance, and if they get enough signatures, the municipality in question would then have to hold a referendum on whether or not the expanded non-discrimination ordinances are okay. In addition to that, it carves out that when it comes to public bathrooms, restrooms, showers, all the usual stuff that we talk about with HB 2, only the General Assembly has the right to regulate who can and cannot use which restroom.
So the governor, who has been urging—
It's all very straightforward. Very straightforward.
The governor, who has been urging some sort of compromise on this, says he's concerned that this, and I quote here, this legislation as written fails the basic test of restoring our reputation, removing discrimination, and bringing jobs and sports back to the state. And Chris Groh, who is executive director of Equality NC, says he is certain that this will not bring back business or sporting events and only serves to reinforce the damage.
The problem that they have here, and this has gone through five iterations as well as the failed special session, when they talk about this clean repeal, which is what you hear Chris Groh and Governor Cooper talk about, essentially what they're saying is just wipe out HB 2 and go from there. The Republican caucus is not going to do that. And then when we get to the issue of the sporting events and the other things, if you don't have protections for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, then I don't think that's going to be enough to bring back the NCAA and the ACC and others. So, again, the legislators find themselves locked in this no man's land. So even if it passed, I don't think it would make a tangible difference with these groups.
Republican Representative Chuck McGrady, who's from Hendersonville, had a news conference at which he said the legislature needs to act before HB2 causes more economic damage. Is that the first time a Republican has admitted this?
No, it's not. In fact, that gets back to the special session in December that Eric was referencing.
Okay.
There is now general understanding that House Bill 2 is having an economic impact on the state and the reputation of the state. In fact, Brian Moynihan, the CEO of Bank of America, said this week that it is having an economic impact without a doubt, and that HB2, the big thing is you can't necessarily quantify it in numbers because you don't know which companies aren't even considering North Carolina expansion.
What he said is it's actually worse than the estimates of the losses. Go ahead, Tom. I'm sorry.
No. I mean, because if you're not even on the list, if you're not even up for consideration, you know, you have no idea. There's no way to quantify what would be potentially a large economic
clearly
impact.
Legislative leaders are not listening to the head of the NBA or the people who run the ACC tournament, et cetera, and the NCAA. Do they listen to Brian Moynihan?
They haven't. I mean, they've had a petition of
he signed the original
200,
letter, yeah.
200 CEOs right. who have said that HB2 needs to go, and they haven't taken action. So I would say they have not listened.
Glenn Perkins.
I think best case scenario if this thing does pass is that it might give cover to some sporting organizations or people who are looking for cover to come back. They'll be able to say we didn't come back until they repealed HB2. That might work. I agree with Tom. It doesn't go nearly as far as the LGBT community would want it to go. It doesn't even come close. But there might be a possibility out there that if you're a company looking to do business here, or you're the NCAA, whatever, the NBA, you can say House Bill 2 is technically repealed.
Mm-hmm. Just out of curiosity, I had not planned to ask this question. The NBA All-Star Game was last weekend in New Orleans. It was to have been here. Did anybody on the broadcast say that this game was scheduled originally for Charlotte, but now it's in New Orleans because of HB2? Did they say anything about the moving of the event?
You know, I never saw coverage of that. I watched some of it, but I don't know is my answer. I just don't know.
In Washington, all this may be a moot point because in Washington, the Trump administration is rescinding guidance issued by the Obama administration on the rights of transgender students to use bathrooms. So what does this mean?
Well, here's what the Obama administration originally did. And this all boils down to the Obama administration's interpretation of what the word sex means in terms of a protected class under the 1964 Civil Rights Act and the different chapters or titles in that law. The Obama administration defined sex to include gender identity, gender expression, and sexual orientation. And a few years ago, they put out guidance to school districts. Actually, it's colleges, universities, any school that takes federal dollars.
Is it Title IX money?
This is Title IX money. Mm-hmm. And this is the guidance basically said, look, we think that transgender students should be able to use the restroom and locker room that corresponds with their gender identity.
Okay.
And that created, you know, a whole lot of movement on this issue. This reversal goes back to the Trump administration now saying sex is nothing more than what you are, whether you're born a boy or a girl, and that this is something that should be decided on a local level. But there are all kinds of interesting questions that raises. The first and foremost here in North Carolina is, well, local school districts can't decide this on a local level. This is because, you know, in the past they've been stuck between federal law and state law. The state law right now is still House Bill 2. So it is clear that they cannot do this. So the school boards are out. State trying to decide this. It's very interesting because there is an argument out there that this could help take some of the steam away from the moves to try to repeal House Bill 2 because it takes away the risk of losing hundreds of millions of dollars of Title IX money potentially.
Which, as you remember, was a huge point last spring when the federal lawsuits came.
Yeah, but I just question how much that was really resonating with Republican lawmakers because they didn't really start moving on it until businesses started reacting to this, until sports, as you keep mentioning, Mike, because sports leagues started reacting to this. And I spoke with one law professor who focuses on LGBT issues, and she actually thinks that this could actually help the repeal efforts for House Bill 2 because it takes away the escape valve for the General Assembly of having the courts decide this, because the lawsuits are now they're definitely weakened because they've lost some pretty key allies in the U.S. Justice Department and Department of Education.
But there's an article in The Observer this morning, and I'm not sure that I completely understood because I kind of had to read it very quickly, that talks about what this move in Washington among the Trump administration people and the Secretary of Education and also the Department of Justice up there, what impact this may have on court decisions moving forward, and that the Supreme Court may decide to kick this back to the lower courts and not hear the case at all.
And that's specific to a case that's supposed to be heard, I believe, on March 28th. It's certainly next month.
That's the Fourth Circuit case.
Yeah, it is. It's a case of Gavin Grimm, who's a transgender.
Why would they do that? I mean, why would they kick it back?
Well, it's all about deferential to administration guidance. And it's a really interesting point because a cornerstone of the legal case is in the Gavin Grimm case, in the lawsuit that the ACLU here in North Carolina is part of challenging House Bill 2, all deals with this definition of a broader protection under the word sex that was seen by the Obama administration. That's now gone. Mm. So the Supreme Court could easily say, well, now we have this new guidance, kick it back down to a district court, the lower court that you were mentioning, to say, what does this mean for this case with this new guidance? We still don't know what the Supreme Court will do, but it leaves a lot of open questions.
And yet, I also read this morning that HB 2 and its impact on North Carolina is leading other states who had been considering similar legislation to not do it. Mm-hmm. They're learning their lesson from us, and we're not learning our lesson from us. Is that essentially it?
I think that is it, although, and Tom or anyone else correct me, I believe Texas is continuing to consider their law, right?
I'm not sure where it stands specifically. The two biggest states that we're looking to this, Virginia, they have now stopped.
Yes.
In Texas, and that is – it had been pulled, but it was still – you know, it's still been filed, so we're waiting to see what the motion will do.
But remember,
Tennessee's
Mike,
on the
if I can break into this at all, to what we were talking earlier about the hypocrisy sometimes between different bodies and parties, presumably the philosophy behind this elaborate series of steps that local governments would now have to take would be to make sure that they don't act hastily and that they don't, you know, that they involve the public and make an informed decision. And
I know where you're going here.
Yeah, the ultimate example of that happening is, in fact, HB 2, done very quickly.
One day.
And yeah, boom. Oh, we did it. We signed it. Oh, what
created,
was
passed, signed by the governor.
And
I was going to mention real quickly,
if they
though.
Would apply that to themselves.
You know, if for people who are thinking, well, North Carolina is the bellwether for other states to avoid this, remember, Indiana had gone down this road and reversed course. And then Georgia, their governor actually vetoed a very similar law because of these same concerns. So it is not as though there weren't warnings out there.
And it was then Governor Mike Pence of Indiana that eventually rescinded that was technically a Religious Freedom Restoration Act, slightly different, but still. The business impact was,
and you know what swung that? The NCAA Final Four.
So now you get to butt in, Anne, because it's time to talk about teachers. Good news for teachers, at least potentially good news for teachers in North Carolina this week. Governor Cooper has proposed average pay raises of 5% for teachers this year and next in his upcoming budget. Is that considered a lot?
Well, I don't know. I guess it depends on the average is 5%. And this is sort of just the opening
three,
step in an elaborate dance that – and nobody is surprised, I don't think, that there is talk about – do we have to cut to go to?
No. Yeah, we do. We do.
Sorry,
we do.
You had your hand in the air.
I always have my hand in the air.
Okay. So
saying you're number one, Ann. Go ahead.
Yeah. So he came to Collinswood Language Academy in Charlotte to make his announcement, and he held a panel discussion with a number of teachers, and I think they came away really energized and – yes, this is saying there's going to be a fairly significant raise, although I've heard teachers say that's not terribly significant, and especially when the average is 5%, he's saying nobody's going to get less than 3%. Some of them will get more. I think the most experienced teachers are really hoping that they will be on the more end because they have been on the less, if not zero, end for the last several years.
No matter what it is, here's what Roy Cooper says it is.
Under my plan, at this rate, North Carolina will be ranked the best in the Southeast in teacher salaries in 3 years.
That's pretty good, it would seem to me, if it goes through. This will all cost the state $813 million, but the governor says taxes would not have to be raised to pay for it. But he seems to have alluded to the need to lose some tax cuts that the legislature had in their back pocket, and he's encouraged the business community to tell the General Assembly to not cut the corporate tax rate again, instead raise teacher pay. Is that likely to happen, do you think? Business coming to the legislature to say, hey, Don't give us a tax cut.
Well, it is an interesting dynamic in that I think most businesses would support teacher raises and that the state does have a surplus to work with. So we're not starting from zero. There's a little over $500,000, not $500 million available for this. So, yeah, but the details, there are just no details out there yet. And we do have both houses saying they're also on board for the tax or for the teacher raises. But then there's kind of a whole dynamic of who's responsible for the fact that things have gotten as low as they have and who's going to take the credit for whatever emerges.
Well, indeed, because Senate President Pro Tem Phil Berger released a statement saying after he opposed, he being Governor Cooper, after he opposed recent Republican budgets that increased average teacher pay by 15.5%, we are pleased Roy Cooper has finally joined legislative efforts to undo the damage of years of Democratic teacher furloughs and pay freezes. Is that a sign that this will pass?
I think it's a sign of the animosity between one branch of government and the other. I mean, it's so funny because if you look at it, these are two things where the General Assembly and the governor are like in lockstep, right? They should be simpatico on this. This is great. This is something we can get done. Bipartisan, yeehaw. Wait a minute. Democrat, Republican, we're going to fight. And that seems to be what's being signaled here right off the bat.
This is completely the battle for credit. I mean, that's all this is a battle for who did it.
And there was a teacher pay raise under Governor McCrory with the legislature.
A couple of them.
But Governor Cooper says that some of these teachers may have seen pay decreases. Is that true?
Well,
they changed a lot of the structures in terms of credit for master's degree. They changed the step where you got a raise every year. So if you are at the top of the scale, and I think there have also been some increases in their contributions to benefits. So I think it is certainly possible that some teachers have seen their paychecks go down. And this is all about, they talk about these furloughs and freezes that happened under Democrats, and that is absolutely true. It was also under the Great Recession. So I think at the time, this was not Democrats saying, let's cut teacher pay. And the question is how well we've recovered from that.
So we have the legislature allegedly wanting to give teachers pay raises. We have the governor who said he wants to give them a pay raise. This looks like a win-win, no-brainer situation. But the Observer editorial board says two things could sink this, details and politics.
Right, and the politics is what we were just talking about here. And the details are, again, who gets the raise, how much, is it just sort of an across-the-board because you're here and you're doing your job? Is it tied to some of these performance bonuses that the legislature has put in that have distributed some pretty significant, several thousand dollars worth of bonuses based on student test scores, but there's also been a lot of controversy over who gets it and who doesn't.
Well, and also where that money comes from. I mean, again, you're talking $800 million. What you're going to see here, the real fight, is also going – not just credit, but how it's paid for. Republican lawmakers continue to argue, and they firmly believe this, and there are arguments that back up their – or the numbers that back up the arguments that one of the reasons that North Carolina is dealing with a $500 million surplus is their tax policy. And Republicans and Democrats disagree on that. But it is a core North Carolina Republican belief. And if – I mean, unless – Cooper can really find a whole lot of businesses who vocally go out and say, don't worry about cutting our taxes. It's going to be a tough sell. So the question then is, where does the money come from in order to make this happen?
And Tom, I think you're getting to the essence of whether Governor Roy Cooper can succeed, because it is all dependent on how he can rally publicly and use the bully pulpit and whether people follow him. That's the key to him pushing the legislature if he can.
Well, there's more school news, and among that we have the numbers on the number of Charlotte Mecklenburg students who attend charter schools. It's the highest number ever, and we'll give you that number when we come back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Southern Spring Home and Garden Show, today through Sunday and March 3rd through 5th at the Park Expo. Special guest, American picker Frank Fritz, cooking demonstrations and decorating ideas, Southern Spring Home and Garden Show.com. The Trump administration issues new deportation guidelines after a string of court defeats. Members of Congress encounter protesters at fiery town hall meetings around the country. Obama-era transgender policies for schools are being rolled back. Just some of the stories talked about coming up on Point with guest host Ray Suarez coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. And I want to remind you, you can join this conversation as well at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks and use the hashtag WFAE Roundup. There's more to come. Stay with us.
It's a new administration's first 100 days, and the news is flying fast.
Protesters arrived here.
Keystone XL pipeline.
The Affordable Care Act.
New refugee
Obamacare.
Admissions for
all things considered will be here to help you make sense of it all. Listen every day.
Stay connected at 90.7 WFAE at WFAE.org and with our mobile app.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup with Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer of the Charlotte Business Journal, Glenn Birkins, editor, publisher of QCityMetro.com, Tom Bullock from WFAE News, and Andos Helms from the Charlotte Observer. We have the numbers on the number of Charlotte-Mecklenburg students attending charter schools. It's the highest number ever, and that number, Andos Helms, is...
just under 17,000.
These schools are growing faster than CMS. So what kind of a message does that send?
Well, it sends a mixed message. And that's part of the reason that I was interested in getting these numbers. They don't actually put out a press release or anything, but CMS does track them because about this time of year, they start planning for the coming year's budget. And the way this works is there's X number of students who are in public schools. And by that, I mean CMS and charter schools. And whatever chunk of students goes to the charter schools, that chunk of county money goes with them. So This time last year, CMS was saying, we have seen exponential growth in charter schools. They're opening more. They're expanding. Parents are choosing them. So we think about 4 out of every 5 public school growth is going to go to the charter schools.
Is the cost per pupil at charter schools substantially different than it is in CMS?
Technically, it is the same amount for operating. There are some little things they can quibble about. They don't get capital money. They don't get money to build buildings. So what you always hear from the charter school people is if we get $8,000 a year, that has to include not only our teachers and our books and our technology, but the lease on our building or however we're doing a building.
But still, far and away, CMS has the bulk of students, even when you combine charter school attendance with private schools and people being schooled at home. Are we likely to see, however, quicker growth in all of these alternative options under the Betsy DeVos administration of the Department of Education in Washington?
Well, that's not clear. I mean, charter schools are still managed by the state, although we do have a very pro-charter school state legislature and the whole educational apparatus, but they have kind of slowed down, and that's been one of the dynamics why the charter school growth was actually not as large as CMS had thought it would be this time last year, because the state did take a couple of these schools that had been struggling for years and said, no, we're not going to renew this, we're not going to keep giving you money. The charter schools also see this choice dynamic, which is that right now all the families that are trying to figure out where their kids might go to school next year are putting in applications maybe for CMS magnet schools. They may go to 3 or 4 or 5 charter schools and enter their name in the lobby. And when it all shakes out, their kid may be enrolled in 5 schools. And there's no real benefit to them to make the decision now. So they keep their names on all those lists. So you have some charter schools that go into June saying, wow, look at this. Every seat is filled and we have a long waiting list. And they walk in August and they're looking at empty seats. So that it is very difficult for everybody to be sure how this is going to evolve.
There was also student assignment news this week, and you reported, Ann, that up to 27,000 students in 35 low-performing CMS schools could get a new path to transfer out. What's that all about? Fill us in.
This is about all these lofty goals that they've been talking about for almost 2 years now starting to get real as they have to figure out how does this actually happen. And they still have big decisions to make about boundaries, but this is still part of the choice-based plan that was approved in very broad strokes in November. So first of all, there was this out for kids in schools that have been on the state's low-performing list for 3 years in a row. And that's only six schools in Charlotte-Mecklenburg. And so they also started talking about, okay, these are the schools that are going to take these students in. There's been a lot of interest in that. What does that mean for these schools? But as the school board members discussed this in a special meeting on Monday night that not a lot of people were there for, they started saying, you know, those six schools are not the only six schools with real performance issues. There may be not even the six worst schools. So should we be opening this up to more? And there's not been a vote. There would be a public hearing and a vote before anything happened. But what they instructed the staff to do was to come back to us with a draft policy that would say not just that low-performing three-year list, but any school that has a D or F on the school grades. And that's a very large number of students.
This is very complicated, and it all may change under Brian Wilcox, but people need to read – parents particularly need to read your articles in the newspaper this week to kind of follow their way – feel their way through this, because it is
and
unfolding,
I think people,
and complex.
When you start saying – this is how this affects your school, people
right.
get intensely interested.
Lowe's up in Mooresville, 430 corporate office employees, Eric, at Lowe's headquarters in Mooresville, along with 70 support personnel in Wilkesboro, lost their jobs this week as that company tries to become leaner and more efficient. Is Lowe's in trouble?
No, I don't think Lowe's is in trouble, but I think that, like,
they've had a round of layoffs in the store.
They have, but I think overall it's something less than 1% of their total employee count. So I wouldn't say that they're in trouble. I would say that, you know, like most publicly held companies, they're under constant pressure to perform better and to deliver better for shareholders. And this is nothing new, but they have the big brother of Home Depot always sort of looking down at them. And right now, Home Depot, which is already a much larger company, is growing at a faster rate than Lowe's. And so, you know, those comparisons.
So it is more profitable.
Even though it's 1% of their full workforce, this layoff, the full workforce is something like 285,000 people. What's the impact of 430 people on Mooresville? What's the economic impact of that?
Well, I mean, I can't put a direct dollar figure on it, but obviously it's very damaging. I mean, you lose 400 or 430 high-paying jobs, that is never good. There's no way to make that pleasant. So, yeah, that hurts.
There's another story this week that's unfolded over the last several days that becomes more mysterious and somewhat troubling, and that is the discovery that it took Mecklenburg County's Public Health Department several months to notify 185 women that their cervical exams came back abnormal. They knew about this in January. The commission held a closed meeting with Dina DiOrio, the county manager, in which this was explained to them. It was a personnel issue, they said, and yet four people unidentified have been fired. But that's not really the story.
Not even fired, necessarily.
They're not there anymore.
They left.
Yeah,
but
that's one of the big mysteries here.
Right.
I mean, you know.
The first mystery, Tom, is why was this a closed meeting since there was not specific discussion of personnel? That's the first fight that has emerged.
Yeah, it would be if they were saying by name – this person did this, and we are firing them or suspending them or whatever, that would be legitimate under North Carolina open meetings law. To say we're going in because it involves our personnel, well, everything they do involves their personnel.
Correct.
So, and you have now county commissioners who are normally pretty big advocates for open meetings saying, oh, yeah, we were in there, and, you know, even saying maybe we sort of wondered about it after the fact, that they didn't step in and say we may be violating the law here.
And several years ago, there was a problem evidently with getting accurate information back to people who had HIV tests. Some were told that they did have it when, in fact, they didn't, and also the other way around. And there have been calls to Bill James and other members of the commission saying that the problem might extend beyond this one exam. Is this a pattern emerging of a problem at the Department of Health, do you think?
Well, I think that's what all these questions are. And now there were the 185, but then later in the week it came out that maybe there were up to 100 that were kind of fuzzy, right? An additional 100?
What they have said is that they were recalling 100 of the 185. Okay. So I think there's not a larger number.
Okay, so the 185, but then you mentioned the HIV example and the fact that this went on for 8 months, this being the cervical cancer warnings or the updates on the test. So I don't think it's unreasonable to wonder whether there are additional cases.
And really the broader context of this, the historic context, is this distrust that is understandably out there among communities of color, among low-income people, that when it comes to medical treatment, they really are not treated the same. And I think that this happened is bad, that she apparently, she or he, I don't know who the nurse was, but was able to basically not do the job for approximately 8 months before it finally came to someone's attention, which is why some supervisors are out. But then after it came to light that they went behind closed doors to basically save face rather than come out. And I believe the people they haven't reached are hard to reach. You know, they don't.
But what you're saying, Ann, that is exactly what ran through my mind, were the horrible precedents from government in terms of eugenics, in terms of tests that they knew were harming people. I'm not saying this is the same, but it conjures up that kind of distrust.
Well, one of the commissioners said this would not have happened to somebody in Myers Park.
Well, I think we can definitely say that it's not the same, but it does play into that narrative that if you are from poor communities, if you're from communities of color, and you depend on these public services, that you're not going to get the level of service that you deserve.
As long as you're jumping in here, Glenn, let's talk about something else that is kind of particularly disturbing, I think, both as a historical landmark and also in the African-American community, and that is the fact that the Excelsior Club, which is on the west side, it's been there forever. It's a club that – I'll let you talk about
it. It's been there 73 years.
Give me the historical context of the – for people who are not from here, tell me why the Excelsior Club is significant.
It is an icon in the African-American community. Back during the era of Jim Crow, when African Americans were not permitted in white-owned social clubs, the Excelsior Club was the place to be.
Big performers.
Louis Armstrong,
Nat King Cole,
people like that would come to Charlotte to perform in this club. It was known up and down the Eastern Seaboard. It wasn't just a Charlotte thing.
Well, it's in bankruptcy. That's the reason why we're talking about
this. Well, not bankruptcy. It's in foreclosure. The owner. The mortgage holder, called the note because the current owner, attorney James Ferguson, he shut the club down in back in June to do some renovations. He said once he shut it down and started looking at it, he realized that the needed renovations were far more extensive than he realized. And basically, the whole thing started bleeding money, and he hasn't been able to open it up again.
And he owes $174,000 in unpaid back taxes. What has he said about that?
He didn't take any questions, so he made a statement and he left.
The former owner is Ken Kuntz, and he had something to say about all this as well.
And that socioeconomic group, black, that were a part of the early days of the Excelsior Club, that same commensurate level of people don't come to places like the Excelsior Club. Or they don't come to the Excelsior Club, period. They like to go give the money to the white people, and places that got them to where they are ain't good enough for them anymore.
Is this a matter of that? Is it a matter of shifting tastes, a matter of just times changing, and therefore this club isn't needed anymore the way it was?
It's a matter of all that. Everything Ken said is true, but it's not the whole truth. I think to a large degree, the club has not kept up with the times.
Okay.
It needs a lot of work. I've been in it a number of times. It's not the kind of physical facility that a person would want to go into necessarily in 2017. Mm-hmm.
And it's certainly not just a black thing. You know, we've seen in Charlotte, as Charlotte grows and new places develop and newcomers come in, we've seen a number of local landmarks.
Double Door Inn just this year.
Fremont Music Hall, et cetera. Yeah.
What it has is a great history, and I think it has a great brand. I think the Excelsior Club can be saved. I think it would take a lot of money to do it.
Let's talk about House Bill 100 for a moment before we run out of time, because since 2002, judicial elections in North Carolina have been considered nonpartisan races. Party affiliation for candidates does not appear on the ballot, but now the General Assembly is considering changing that. Tom, why?
Well, the Republicans who sponsored this bill say it's in order to educate North Carolina voters, and because North Carolina voters, they say, don't know that much about judges. This is part of a broader context, though. House Bill 100 specifically deals with district and superior court judges. They actually now are the last judges that are still considered nonpartisan elections. Mm-hmm. Because, again, stop me if you've heard this before, in a special session in December, the General Assembly changed the North Carolina Supreme Court elections to a partisan election and appellate courts to partisan elections. And they did that after a Democrat defeated a Republican for the seat for a seat
now
on the Supreme
we're getting to the heart of the matter.
Court, and now the North Carolina Supreme Court is controlled by liberal justices 4-3. So this is actually a bigger deal than probably most people will realize.
Are they also thinking at the legislature that if you put an R or a D next to a candidate's name, that since the state is primarily Republican, you're more prone to vote for the R outside of the big cities?
I think that would be a very safe assumption to make.
Yeah, but and here's the key, though. We would become one of seven states in the United States to have all of our judicial races partisan affairs. There's a reason that that line is drawn. And this is actually – these are not my words. These are words of a freshman representative, Joe John of Raleigh, who spoke for the first time on the floor about House Bill 100. He also happens to be a former district court judge and superior court judge and appellate court judge. And his speech I found to be really fascinating because he says, election campaigns threaten to blur the fine line between the sacred independence of the judicial branch and the raw red meat of partisan politics. And what he's getting at here is simple. If judges now have to rely on party affiliation for elections, you could easily draw a line that says they will also tend to be more activist judges, regardless of whether they are Republican or Democrat, because they need to keep the party faithful
right.
happy.
We have to end on a happy note. I'm happy.
That's
to
not
say.
Happy enough.
No, that's not happy enough. It's a happy note that sounds like fake news, or at least some sort of alternative fact, because I've been assured that this is true. Traffic here isn't all that bad. So how did experts arrive at this stunning conclusion?
All right.
I've stumped the panel.
No.
We have been ranked 42nd most congested out of 240 cities in the United States. Baton Rouge, Nashville, North Charleston.
Hometown. My hometown. Yeah. Traffic is terrible there.
Where? Baton Rouge?
Yes.
Nashville, North Charleston, and Ann Arbor were worse. Should we take consolation from that?
No, because we're growing faster than they are.
Yes.
Raleigh and Greensboro fared
so that's
far
not a happy
better
ending.
Than we did. Raleigh was 72nd with drivers spending only 18 hours in congestion last year. Greensboro was 232nd. Drivers spent 4.2 hours in congestion in Greensboro. Here, we spend 23.4 hours stuck in traffic. Can we use this in Raleigh to our benefit?
Well, not stuck, Mike. That's more opportunity to listen to this show and others, right?
Indeed it
Ooh,
is.
Now
and we'll
the
end
happy
there.
Ending.
Eric Spanberg, Ann Doss Helms, Glenn Birkins, Tom Bullock. Thank you all.